To order a meeting of the Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness for Thursday, February the 1st, 2007. Just to give you an idea of what the work plan is for the evening, this is a combination of invited testimony and public testimony. And so we're going to start out with the invited testimony. This is not the only public hearing opportunity we will have on Measure 37 issues or the work of the Land Use Fairness Committee. So the fact that if we don't get to everybody this evening, that doesn't mean that you will be precluded from having an opportunity to offer your views. So do understand that. We would ask that people be brief in their remarks. We're generally going to be looking in the public testimony for comments of 2 minutes or less. And so things have been said already. Make sure that you don't just repeat those, because it's the quality of the comments rather than the quantity that that is important to our deliberations. And we do intend to conclude the hearing promptly at 7 p.m. because committee members have some other commitments. But if you had come to testify, understand this is not your only opportunity to do so. And there are several people on the list who had marked the sign-up sheets as having come from more than 100 miles, and so we'll be taking those first and then going in the order in which they signed up. So with that, we will begin the invited testimony. I'd like to invite first Director Lane Shetterly from DLCD.
Can I bring my lawyer with me, Mr. Chair?
You may.
You are a lawyer, Lane.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Representative Girard, I used to be a lawyer. I now specialize in being a client. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I think we were invited today to address a decision that came out of the Court of Appeals yesterday that has some fairly substantial implications in the processing of Measure 37 claims. I do have Richard Whitman with me from the Department of Justice, and if you'd like, I think what we can do is let Richard describe the decision to you, and be happy to answer any questions, and then we'll be on our way so you can receive whatever other testimony you have for today.
Please.
Co-Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman from the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today to talk to you about a decision that was issued by the Oregon Court of Appeals yesterday, called Corey versus Department of Land Conservation and Development. Before I get into that, let me set the stage a little bit. Measure 37 provides that Measure 37 does not provide actually exactly how people who are unhappy with the Measure 37 decision are to appeal a Measure 37 decision. So one issue that's been unclear from the start is whether Measure 37 decisions are appealed to the Circuit Court or Measure 37 decisions are appealed to the Court of Appeals. We had a decision in a case called Hoff about a year ago from the Oregon Court of Appeals that indicated in an unpublished decision that Measure 37 claimants who are unhappy with the relief that they've been provided have the right to challenge that in the circuit court. And so for the last year or so, we've had cases, over 130 now, brought in the circuit courts around the state of Oregon. Early on, though, because of the uncertainty about where the proper place for appeal was, it put in the notice of appeal rights for these decisions that they could be possibly appealed to the Court of Appeals or to the Circuit Court. So we had a few cases early on that were filed, double filed, both in the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals. And one of these cases that was double filed is this Corey case that a decision was issued on yesterday. Yesterday, what the Court of Appeals held in this published opinion is that jurisdiction for review of a state agency order on a Measure 37 claim lies in the Oregon Court of Appeals. And the reason for that is that the state, when it's reviewing a Measure 37 claim, first, according to the Court of Appeals, makes a determination that the claimant is, in fact, entitled to relief under Measure 37, and then makes a second determination in terms of the scope of the type of relief and the scope of relief that is to be provided. And that under the Due Process Clause of the Federal Constitution, because the state has already made a determination that the individual has a right to relief, that then the second determination in terms of the scope of that relief is a determination about a property interest that is protected for purposes of the Due Process Clause of the Federal Constitution. And what that means in English is that the person who has that entitlement is entitled to a hearing before the government makes a final decision as to the scope of that right. And under Oregon law, the way that person is provided a hearing is under our State Administrative Procedures Act is through something called a contested case. So the effect of the Court of Appeals decision is that according to this opinion, Measure 37 claimants to the state are entitled to a contested case hearing before there is a final decision on the scope of Measure 37 relief that's going to be provided. And so that's basically the opinion. This did, frankly, come as a bit of a surprise to the state.
Chair, that's a bit of an understatement.
This issue, I have to say, this issue was not briefed to the Court of Appeals. We did have a motion to determine jurisdiction that had been pending for some time before the Court of Appeals, but nobody had argued that there was a right to a contested case hearing and that jurisdiction was in the Court of Appeals for that reason. So this does come as a surprise. We're currently continuing to evaluate the opinion and what its ramifications might be, both as a legal matter and as a practical matter with our clients. And that's where we are at this point in time.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I may then, again, I think Richard said it, but I want to underscore the fact that the decision yesterday was 180 degrees at odds with an unpublished decision in the Hoff case that we got a year ago. So we've been operating under the authority of that order for a year in the process by which I've already described to you in the committee hearing last week, by which we make these claim determinations, and then challenges to those determinations have been going forward in the circuit courts of the state. And so that plus the fact that this issue was not briefed as part of any motion before the court, and there was no oral argument on this being just a motion to determine jurisdiction, that is why, in part, it came really as a surprise to us, both in terms of a reversal of a decision on the same issue that was made a year ago and also the fact that it had not been briefed or argued. Just in terms of the impact, I think, and this is really back of the envelope kind of picture here, but I'll have ask Richard to nudge me if I step too far out of the limits. But I think what that means in terms now of claims to our department would be that, let me back up. What I said when I was before you earlier was that we get to a point where we issue a draft report that recommends the final decision. We mail that to claimants and anybody else who has submitted comments, and then we accept written comments back, make any adjustments that are appropriate based on those written comments, and then we issue a final order. And that is the order then from which any appeals go forward in the circuit courts. Now, I believe what we would do under the holding of this case would be one of two things. If we determine that the claim is not valid, let's say we just determine that the claimant has not established ownership, or that for some other reason there is no validity to the claim, we would issue, I believe, a final order to that effect, because the court says that you only get a contested case hearing if there's a determination that there is validity, and then the contested case proceeding addresses the scope of the waivers. So, and those cases that really are 10% or fewer, where we just make an outright denial of a claim based on some factual or legal issue, we would do what we've been doing. We'd issue a final order, and that would be the end of it. If we make a determination, however, under this holding from yesterday, that a claim is valid, but then we would make a recommendation as to the extent of the waiver, as I think I've described too. In many cases, claimant is seeking one thing, and we determine that the law, in fact, allows something different, perhaps less than what the claimant has been asked, what the claimant is requesting. In those cases, we would issue not a final order, but a proposed order. And we would send that out to the claimant and to anybody else, I assume, who's made comments in the proceeding. We would then have to allow them time within which to request a hearing on that proposed order. If they request the hearing, then we would have to accommodate that and provide them with a hearing in front of a hearings officer. And then after the hearing, issue a final order. And that, again, still under the measure, would have to be accommodated within 180 days from the date that a claim has been submitted.
Committee, any questions about what we just went from? Representative Roba.
Thank you, Chair. So the hearing and all of it would have to be within the 180 days.
Mr. Chair,
not just the schedule.
Roman, that is correct under the measure. If the regulation complained of continues to apply more than 180 days after the demand has been submitted, that is what subjects the state to liability for damages, costs, and attorney fees. And so until a final order is entered, that regulation is still in effect. That's why we say we believe we would have to make this process occur within that 180-day time frame. And I think I mentioned before that even based on the process that we have in place right now, given the volume of claims that we're dealing with, we're getting them out in the 175-day range.
You may.
Do we need, by this ruling, to go back to the ones that we didn't follow this procedure and redo them?
If I could. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Roblin, we believe that's still an open question. We're still looking at it, but our tentative thinking on that is that orders that are final by operation of law, the appeal period's passed on them, that we don't go back to disturb those orders that are settled. But it is, I want to emphasize, it's still somewhat of an open question that we're looking at. There is an argument that if they were issued in unconstitutional manner, they're void, and that we need to go back and redo them. So that's one of the things we're currently evaluating.
One more follow-up. And if the 180 days had gone past,
you wouldn't be a lawyer.
There would be no point in having the appeal, because they would be, they would get there and be due compensation.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Roblin, that's possible, although once, if we could go back and fix the problem in terms of no hearing and stop the offending regulations from applying, we would argue that they no longer have a right to compensation.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. I guess first, what percent of cases are affected? Because you said it's only if, I mean, how, what? So what percent get denied because it doesn't affect those? And then what percent are you saying we agree with you entirely?
It's a good question, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer. We've not been keeping track of those kinds of statistics because they haven't been relevant really to what we've been doing. I will tell you, based on what I've seen, I'm guessing roughly half. Would you say that's about accurate?
Yeah.
Where the claimant is seeking this, we give something, we give a waiver, but it's something less than that. I would say, yeah, it's roughly half of the claims.
Follow up.
You may.
And just so I'm clear, the claimant has to initiate this, not you guys. So even if you guys say, claimant asks for A, and B, you say, no, you're only entitled to A, claimant says, that's okay, no problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that is correct. There is still the process issue in that sense that you have first the proposed order, then a timeout for them to evaluate and determine whether or not to request an appeal. But if they don't appeal, yes, then that proposed order becomes a final order.
And what's the timeline of that timeout appeal?
I don't know. Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, there is no timeline right now because we don't have any process like that. I'm not sure what it would have to be something that satisfies due process in order to give them time to respond to a proposed order and request an appeal. I'm not sure if there's a benchmark.
If I could, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, the fastest contested case proceeding that I've seen in a regulatory process is roughly 40 to 50 days. For our state agency, so that'll give you some sense.
A couple more, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Okay. Are you going to appeal this decision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that's still under discussion. I think the first step would be a motion for reconsideration before the Court of Appeals, and then an appeal from there to the Supreme Court.
And a final question, Mr. Chair. It's happened in other cases. I'm not an attorney. You guys are the attorneys. So you tell me. But there have been cases where an appellate court of appeals, issues an opinion, and the governing body, because of the surprise or the unexpected amount of, you know, of the opinion, goes to the Oregon Supreme Court and asks for a stay on that opinion until until that decision can be appealed to them. Yeah. Likeliness of that happening.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Byer, that's a very good question and a point that I'm glad you asked about because I intended to touch on it. The Court of Appeals decision will not take legal effect until there is an appellate mandate issued, until there's a final appellate judgment in the case. That won't occur until the options for reconsideration or petition for review to the Supreme Court are exhausted if we elect to take those. So the opinion is out, but it doesn't have immediate legal effect in terms of being binding on the state or local government for that matter, in terms of what we're required to do. So we don't, the direct answer to your question is we don't need to seek a stay right now. Until there's a final appellate decision and judgment on this issue, we're not bound by the order.
What is that?
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we are going to get to more invited testimony and public hearing, but possibly, so I'll just have one question. Is it only the claimant who would possibly have rights? I didn't like my question, Mr. Chair. Is it possible that a neighbor who received one of the notices also could get into a situation to have some rights to a contested claim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, it's a very good question, and I'm afraid I don't have an answer to that right now. The argument would be that the neighbor's interest in outcome is also a protected property interest under the Due Process Clause. We believed previously that we had provided enough due process through the notice and comment process that we have in place now for reviewing claims. I think we would continue to argue that that is enough to meet the requirements of the federal constitution, but I have to say this opinion throws that into some question.
Representative Robles.
And Matt Lassen, you had approximately 130 circuit court cases. All of those need to be reviewed or taken from that jurisdiction?
Transfer.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Roblin, that's an issue that will have to be looked at in each case. We're likely to see motions to transfer the cases to the Court of Appeals. There is a statute. I can't quote the statute to you, but there is a statute in place that provides for transfer of cases in these circumstances. So, that's a possibility.
Okay. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got the case just a few minutes ago, so I haven't been able to read it, so I want to understand context. Does the due process rights attach once you file your claim, which it seems like it would, or are you saying only upon the denial are you getting the due process, or do you get your due process rights?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator George, according to this opinion, the rights attach upon the determination of the state that there is an entitlement, that the claimant meets the requirements for relief under Measure 37.
Could I follow?
You may.
Okay, but in a situation where you have counties who have approved claimants' rights. They've in essence made the statement that there are certain rights that are there. Anybody who has filed a Measure 37 claim, who's had any kind of decision made, would then be covered by this due process. And if we tried to change, or if you tried to freeze somehow, in essence, what you'd do is you'd open the state up to huge amounts of liability. If this committee actually did some kind of some people have advocated some kind of moratorium, you'd open the state up to massive liability.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, let me try to clarify this for you. The Court of Appeals has indicated that there is a protected property interest for purposes of the due process clause. So in terms of an entitlement to hearing, an opportunity for a hearing before that right is affected in any way by the government, that is distinguished, even in the language of this opinion, it appears that the court was trying to be careful to use words that do not extend that to the power of the legislature in a legislative process to alter rights that have previously been granted by statute. And there's a long line of cases under both state and federal law that legislatures retain the power and authority to go back and change those rights, at least until they have vested, and then we get back to the question about vested rights.
I'll try to proceed
ahead, although we've got a lot of people who came to the room. This is a new decision that I'm sure will.
Okay. If we can follow up with these two witnesses at some later time.
Yep. No, I'm sure we can.
Because this is really important. I mean, what they're bringing up here is a much bigger issue, and I'd like to read the case, too. So I'm actually working great.
Okay. If we've gotten enough input now, what I'd like to do then is go to the other invited testimony, and I'm hoping that we can get to public testimony by 6 o'clock. So if those who are on schedule for invited testimony could recognize where we'd be aiming for no more than 10 minutes apiece, including the time for questions, which may require a little discipline on the part of our committee as well. Then I'd like to call forward Jim Zupanczyk and Devin Lyon for the Measure 37 Claimants for Fairness, Inc.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members, good evening. Jim Zupanczyk. Pleasure to be with you. I'm here on behalf of Measure 37 Claimants for Fairness, which is an organization that has recently been formed, comprised of Measure 37 claimants throughout the state, who are interested, quite frankly, in two things, one of which is that the will of the voters be respected, and that secondly, that the legislature, whatever it does in its wisdom, would not impair the rights of Measure 37 claimants. I speak to you not only as the president of that organization, but also as one who has practiced real estate law and land use law for 30 years, and so I have been where the rubber meets the road. And the comments that I make this evening and those that we'll make in the subsequent proceedings, I hope will reflect that kind of pragmatic experience. I agree and will certainly keep my comments brief, Co-Chair McPherson, to statements that have not been made thus far and not be redundant. I do agree with a comment that was made previously by Co-Chair Prozonsky that the role of the legislature as a whole should be to be judicious in this review, to exercise wisdom and perspective. That the recognition that the voters, or two-thirds of them approximately, passed this measure, I think is extremely important. That the rights as articulated in this recent Corey decision, which was discussed by Director Federley a few moments ago, should be respected as well. One of the points of that decision was that the waivers create a property interest. And that's extremely important for us to recognize as the articulation from the appellate court. And even if the matter is appealed, primarily to get some further clarification on the procedural due process grounds, we believe that the point of the court that the property interests are maintained by those who hold waivers will in fact be sustained. We also recognize that there's a pragmatic problem with this bubble of claims. And we're here to support doing what's reasonably necessary to be able to afford the state agencies and local government agencies the necessary time to be able to deal with that bubble of claims. Provided, however, that the rights of the claimants which are currently in the queue are not abridged somehow by any extension. The current interpretation of the law is that the premature death of a claimant would cause a transfer of title and therefore the termination of the Measure 37 claim right. We strongly believe that if there's any extension, that all of the claimants need to be protected so that if there was a death, that death would not result in essentially the loss of that right as a matter of law. I'll leave this one last thought with you with respect to just the general process, and I know that you've heard this from others, but I think it's worth reaffirming. As I have seen throughout my entire career, the land use process in this state and in other states is a very, very necessarily arduous process. Measure 37 claims open the gateway into the process, but there are a number of other gates that need to be traversed in order to be able to accomplish a successful development. Much more will be said about that over time. But I think it's important for us to deal with the exigent issue now, which is to deal with the bubble of claims. The other substantive issues having to do with Measure 37 are worthy of a very careful examination over a lengthy period of time. And those things can be segregated from the exigent issue of how to deal with this bubble of claims and the extension that's necessary. So I'll be happy to take your questions.
Any questions for the witness? Mr. Zupanzik, you're let off easy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next invited testimony will be from the American Planning Association.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Gaffori. I'm here tonight representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. I'd like to make just a brief comment before my guests get into the substance of their. I think all our Oregonians are in the process now of learning the dangers of voting on ballot measures that have not been first vetted by the Oregon legislature. All kinds of unintended consequences, and I think this case that just came up yesterday and another one which came today, which you may not even have heard of, are just the beginning. I'd like to let you know that the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association comprises 1,000 members. These members are land use planners and land use lawyers, many in work for government, many are in private practice. We operate, on, as they often say, on both sides of the counter, representing people who do development and people who receive the requests to do the development. And I have tonight Phil Farrington, who is the president of our chapter, and I think a presentation.
Thank you very much for having us speak to you here tonight. As Stephen said, you know, we're a big tent.
Could you identify yourself for the record, just to make sure we know who
Philip Farrington, I'm okay. The president of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. My business address is 123 International Way in Springfield. We're a big tent organization representing not only the professional planners and people doing land use work in the state, but also planning commissioners and a variety of different students and volunteer planners and people interested in planning across the state. Really come with you with, you know, we have a very divergent interest and opinions among our membership, and I'd like to really kind of leave you with really three points that I'd like to make. And first is that really Measure 37 is so full of so many unintended consequences, and you've been hearing about those really from both sides of the issue, and you will certainly in the days and months to come, that the crush of submittals that's been turned in really can't be effectively processed by the resources that are available to city, state, and county planners. They're stretched too thin and really unable to do the good planning work that really they need to be doing as well as processing these claims while meeting the statutory timelines. without being able to do the justice to properly reviewing these claims, it also means that they really are not giving proper credence or ability, as they should, to other claims that non-Measure 37 claimants will have in the queue and be able to do that sound planning work that our communities need across the state. Also, one of the things that's, I think, been touched upon, but in a different venue, perhaps, is not only the due process of the claimants that was the subject of the DAS case that you just heard about, but also the due process of those that are adjacent to the claimants themselves, those that have acquired property, perhaps subsequent to any ability to file a Measure 37 claim, but yet are neighboring a claimant. And are now there's a patchwork of different rules that apply to them differently from any other claimant. That makes it very difficult, really, for planners to effectively do planning, and for our communities, that really makes for a problematic process, as well as really being able to do functionally sound planning in support of our state and communities. We've also provided and have available, if called upon, some ideas about how to reform the review process. Now, the cow's already left the barn with a large number of claims that were filed this past year. There may not be as many in the future. However, we do think that there's a need for reform of the methodologies and processes in reviewing claims. They're so divergent right now across different jurisdictions that we don't believe there's really an equitable application to Measure 37 claims across these various jurisdictions. We support some standardized methods of determining value, of requiring valid appraisals, and ample review processes that can allow the public's interest to be protected, as well as those of not only the claimants but neighboring property owners too. One other thing too that we'd advocate is that really claimants also be given only one bite at the apple. We've heard of instances where, a claimant perhaps might be given a waiver or perhaps even, some compensation, but then might turn around and refile for a different type of use and go at the process yet again, and we feel there should just be one opportunity to really go through the claims process. Finally, I'd just like to say that, the chapter believes that voters never intended for Measure 37 to really give carte blanche to any and all development. We'd be certainly agreeing, I'm sure, with most of you to feel that our land use process is complex, perhaps unduly complex. There are issues of fairness that do need to be addressed, but this isn't necessarily the way that I think voters intended for it to be imparted on such a wholesale with opportunities for really wholesale urban development without regard to location or impacts. These claims can have potentially significant changes to our communities, to local economies, and the infrastructure. Right now, we really have no ability to assess these claims relative to carrying capacities of, say, surface or groundwater resources that these claims may rely upon, and ultimately other jurisdictions that may have to provide the necessary infrastructure should the resources not be available long-term to support those initial developments. So, I think our position is simply that we are proponents of sound planning, that we're here to help and we're here to provide technical resources available to you. We have members in all quarters of the state, and just as we're proposing our assistance to the Big Look Task Force, we also offer our assistance to you as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Kafuri, was the third representative going to speak?
I am a lawyer from Portland, Kerry Richter from Darby Schubert & Bauer. We'd like to make a brief comment on the recent legal developments.
My name is, for the record, is Carrie Richter, and I'm a lawyer at the firm Garvey Schubert Bearer. I was invited to speak to you a little about the Corey case. Mr. Whitman was here, and he covered it fairly comprehensively, so I won't go back. But again, I want to reaffirm that there are more questions as a result of this Corey case than there are answers. There was a more recent case that came down in today, this afternoon, in fact, versus Roe versus Kulongoski, and in that case, the applicant, plaintiff brought a suit in circuit court, and the court determined that this wasn't the case where property rights at issue, and they vacated that circuit court decision. What that suggests is, if you're in the wrong venue, you may be in the wrong venue. And that could foreclose some claimants who have gone to circuit court and should have gone to the Court of Appeals, as the Corey case suggests. So I think that there's not only confusion for claimants, there's confusion for attorneys, and may lead to some malpractice cases, in fact, if attorneys have gone to the wrong forum. I'll leave it at that, but open it up for questions if you have any.
Okay. Any questions for this panel? Representative Garrard.
And sir, you made several statements as to interpreting voter intent. Do you have any data that backs up your conclusions that the voters wanted this or that?
Well, I've heard different things in different studies, so I can't say with perfect knowledge of anything that we've commissioned. I'm taking the sense and the pulse of really the planning community that we represent as to how we believe that, whereas there I think were legitimate issues that of fairness and reforms that are needed in the land use program that were the progeny for Measure 37, you know, we can really only rely upon certain other studies, polls, and data that we've seen that suggest that that is the case, that the voters intended perhaps something less than large corporate scale urban development or ex-urban development, and we're intending really to address the fairness issues that the proponents of Measure 37 really offered as part of the sales for the measure when it was first presented to the voters.
Comment, Mr. Chair?
You may.
So in other words, this is the planner, those planners that voted, this is their intent.
I think it's just the sense for planners as community members and really kind of, and this is a divergent group of people that represent counties and live in communities and counties across the state, that many of whom voted and support Measure 37 in one fashion, but perhaps feel that the progeny of Measure 37 really doesn't reflect what they intended for it to mean.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I was really encouraged by the fact that you were willing to say that the Planning Association was willing to start talking about some of the broader issues that are problems in the land use system. I mean, our land use system, as you said, it's very complex. We have a whole court called the Land Use Board of Appeals to deal with 30 years of litigation that have come out of the land use system. What are some of the areas, especially when we talk about rural relief, some of the areas where the Planning Association would be willing to go as far as looking at some of the issues? I mean, some of the really egregious things like the $80,000 income standard, the issue of rural zoning. Where would we see some negotiation from your association as far as things that would be on the table that this committee could do to fix the complete unfairness of the current system?
I think we're trying to work through some of those issues right now. As a big tent organization, it's difficult for us to really even convene and kind of canvass that opinion and really come to some consensus. So we have been working pretty much at kind of a 30,000-foot level rather than getting down into the mire of, you know, supporting a tract approach or, you know, one house on a tract or one house on a parcel necessarily at this point. We know that you're going to be dealing with a lot of those issues. We have yet to really resolve that one way or another is one that we could approve by consensus. We have been engaged and are talking with some of the work groups that the Big Look Task Force has developed. So we're encouraging that the task force, in fact, look at those elements and take a very thoughtful and deliberative approach to analyzing the system and not do something in a really slapdash kind of manner. That said, just as you've heard from proponents of Measure 37, there's really not an effective way for jurisdictions to be able to do the planning work that they need to do on a day-to-day basis to support their communities and to be able to process all these claims subject to the statutory limitations. There's just really no effective way to do that, and it doesn't do justice for the claimants, it doesn't do justice for the communities, and it doesn't do any justice for the other developers or mom and pop that might be in the queue for some other proposal that they have but are backed up because of this bolus of claims that have come before them. So we're advocating really taking a more deliberative approach and, you know, not only ourselves but the whole community statewide to really ask ourselves what it is that we'd like to see changed, whether it's, let's get down to specifics, but first let's take a broader view of what are the things that we can agree upon and what are the things that we can't agree upon at least now and need to work on further.
Real quickly, if I can, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to encourage your association to continue that line. For so many years, landowners have been frustrated by a very bureaucratic system that has tons of litigation if you're the landowner going through the process. There's a certain irony that planners are whining so much now that they're on the other side of not liking the way the court cases are going. And so I hope that that opens up some doors of dialogue that we can have about fixing the land use system overall. And I appreciate, I mean, if Measure 37 did nothing else, it brought a lot of people together to discuss the overall problems we have with Oregon's land use system. I appreciate your comments.
Well, if I could just add maybe one other comment, Senator, is just that, you know, just as, you know, our program is, has developed and in some ways very unintended consequences over the last 30 years, we feel that just as our system is set up to require periodic review of community plans, the whole system really needs an opportunity now for periodic review. The demographics of the state have changed dramatically since Senate Bill 100. So let's have a broad-scale community dialogue statewide and really look at fairly and objectively at the whole program at large.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There are no further questions. We'll excuse this panel and invite up the League of Oregon Cities, Linda Ludwig.
Maps. I have a constituent that wants me to put the continuing education to planners. And they have a
It's not a bad idea. Good evening, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go ahead and... I'd like to do just a couple of things tonight. I'd like to do a quick update on municipal claims, Measure 37 claims that we have in the state, and also then just touch base real quickly on a couple of our main concerns. If you'll look at the spreadsheet real quick, we do not have a comprehensive listing of municipal claims that have been filed, but I took a quick sampling from a variety of cities within the last few days, and the spreadsheet in front of you, both front and back, the back will show you the total claims. We've got about 200 claims there that have been filed. More than half of these since the November 1st, 2006, getting close to that December 4th deadline. I believe this listing is probably about two-thirds of the total claims throughout the state inside of city limits. My best guess would be there are approximately 250 to 300 muni claims. They generally fall into several categories, either the all regulations, the request for waiver of all regulations that we heard about from the counties a couple of nights ago, or environmental category, could be setbacks, greenbelt, or zoning and comprehensive plan regulations. One type of claim that was unexpected, but we see quite a few of them in the city of Portland, was for signage or billboards. About 25% of all the claims that Portland has received have been for their billboard regulations. Cities with the highest number of claims, no surprise, seem to be within the metro area, with Portland leading right now with about 91 claims, which for them total close to $250 million of claimed value. City of Portland has on hand right now approximately 8 full-time FTEs that work on these claims, with about 4 of their muni attorneys that work on them part-time, just giving you an overall sense. If you flip to the next sheet, you'll see a summary of the Portland statistics. I don't want to spend a lot of time on these, but I want to point out a couple of interesting items. Portland has about a dozen claims on hold by request of the claimant currently, including the largest claim that they've received for $120 million by Zidell for their South Waterfront property. These claims on hold, they're put on hold by written request of the claimant. It stops the 180-day clock completely, which the claimant can resume at any time with another request to the city. During this time, the city works with the claimant to try to solve the development request outside of the Measure 37 process to see if there is another way that they can move that project along. So that's just kind of an interesting piece for your recognition. That list of bullets at the bottom of the page, those significant claims, those have all been received by City of Portland since mid-November of last year. Although at this point, approximately day 790, I think, into the Measure 37 process, cities don't seem to be quite as on the hook as the state or counties for these claims. We believe that ultimately the long-term burden to cities on these claims will very much rest squarely on the shoulders of cities. We've been concerned about the passage of the measure, not just because of the potential claims inside our muni boundaries, but more importantly, those claims that are filed close to city limits inside the UGB or directly outside the UGB. There have been a lot of claims that have been filed. Cities have a lot of interest in those claims, but currently there is no process for cities to be involved in that county claim process. Many counties don't have public hearings for considering waivers. Some do, some don't. It's a mixed bag. And some of them put into their waivers the all regulations category. So we have those claims in the UGB, close to city limits, directly outside the UGB. It's going to be, if they move forward with development, even if a small percentage does, of concern to cities that will be growing, needing to provide services. Now, if you look at this big map, your next page is a very small replication, a photo of that map. This came from the Department of Agriculture today. What I've been looking for is some mapping that will show the context of UGBs or city limits with Measure 37 claims, and we don't have it right yet. But what I'd like to point out to you is just a couple of things on this map. The gray is the UGBs. And if you look on your little map from that large area, which is Salem-Keizer, moving north slightly east, you'll see the city of Woodburn. Well, you'll notice that to the southeast of the city of Woodburn, there is quite a few little red squares, which are the Measure 37 claims right up next to the UGB. This is kind of ironic. City of Woodburn, just after nearly nine years, just got through their periodic review process to expand their UGB $1.5 million later. City of Woodburn have been working very, very hard over the past years. The planning process we're all supposed to go through to establish that gray area, and now we see that it is likely that they could be a bit of a bulge to the southeast portion of that. Likewise, if you move down to Staten, and just up from that, across the highway, it's not labeled on your little map, but it is here, there's the city of Sublimity. Several of these small cities, you'll see quite a few claims around. And there's going to be some pressure to develop around those edges, around those borders. When you look at the Swiss cheese nature of this map or any of these maps, you'll see that there's going to be a tremendous amount of services that will need to be provided. And that's where I get back to that long-term issue. Many of these claims.
Excuse me, Ms. Ludwig-Whitwer.
Okay.
The point where I would like to start the public testimony. So, if you, I don't want to cut you off in mid-sentence, but if we could move to closure here, that would be help us get to accommodate a lot of other people who have come.
Again, it's that provision of infrastructure, the provision of services. We've heard that there will be potentially some of these developments start with community water, community septic services. It will likely not be long before either the growing population in our cities or failing services will put additional strain on the systems that we currently have, which are vastly underfunded. And I know you know that, having heard from me over the course of the last years. So we need time to sort some of this out. Cities need more time to sort out, to process their existing claims. You've heard that from counties. You've heard that from the state. That would be beneficial to the cities right now. Also, we could use more time to deal with the lawful waivers to prior to their development approval so that we can get that right and do that right. Thank you.
Any questions for this witness? Thank you, Ms. Lovett. We appreciate your input. That concludes the...
That's okay. I'll let it go.
That concludes the invited testimony portion. We've wrapped it up so that we have an hour left for public testimony. And just to remind you, what we're going to do is I'm going to take the sign-up sheets and I'm going to go first in the order that people signed up among those who indicated that they came from more than 100 miles to be here. And I'm going to invite people up in groups of three, so we reduce the amount of time it takes to come forward. Please identify yourself for the record, and I would urge you to conclude your remarks in about 2 minutes. Again, I don't want to be cutting people off in mid-sentence, but do try to be concise and get right to the point that you came here to deliver your comments on. And recognize that the invited testimony we just heard is from organizations that represent a lot of Oregonians, and so we allowed more time for that input, and that's the reason why there's relatively less time available for each individual citizen who comes. The first panel of three will be Jean Preet, Barbara Preet, and Don Dean. And please begin by identifying yourselves.
My name is Jean Preto from Sisters.
Great.
And we've had a 200-mile round trip, and so I appreciate the 2 minutes. But the longer I sit there, the more upset I get. So I'm using my 2 minutes to basically vent. My wife and I, the chief petitioners of Monday 37, we're tired of it. And we were in a personal battle for 13 years to try to get our property rights back to build one farmhouse.
Excuse me, sir. You don't need to talk as directly into the microphone. It's getting a little feedback or distortion, so it'll pick you up if you're at normal.
Our 13-year battle was for one farmhouse on a 20-acre farm parcel. And we bought that parcel in 1990. In 1990, we could build a farmhouse or a non-farm dwelling and deal with the taxes issues. In 1993, the door got slammed with the $80,000 rule. So the more I sit here and hear about the whining and the timing and the fairness and all this BS, I just can't stand it. Because during that time, we had land use specialists, attorneys, talk to local county politicians, etc., and nobody had an ear. And nobody could do anything. And nobody cared to do anything. And this whole idea of slamming the door, and actually, we should have been compensated. Well, forget all that. You know, I don't talk legalese. And now we got our claim passed and approved, but we were going to sell the house we're in before we start the house over there. Well, we can't do that, so we're going to look into a bridge loan or a construction loan. Because we have no confidence that something isn't going to happen, another shoe is going to drop, and guess what? We can't build our house after 13 or 14 years. So the fact that nobody addressed our concerns, the fact that after buying that property in 1990 and it became worth a small percentage of it, along with the fact that we couldn't build our retirement home, who cared then? Who talked about fairness then? Not LCDC and a whole bunch of them I can name. I got a brochure from 1,000 Friends of Oregon saying the best thing you can do after we testified here several years ago was to take our land and give it to their trust. But I say, we're not fixing Measure 37. The people know what they're voting for. Each time they got outspent at least 3 or 4 to 1 as far as a ballot measure. It's outrageous that anybody would say they didn't know what they're voting for.
Yeah,
I knew what I was voting for, and I'm saying no moratorium.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Next up, Mrs. Bray.
Thank you. I'm Barbara Preti from Sisters, Preti. Oregon. Proud to be one of the chief petitioners. And my husband's right. You know, people know what they're voting for. They voted for Measure 7. They voted for Measure 37. And last November, they voted to stop intimate domain takings in Oregon. You're telling me people don't know what they're voting for? And then for some person to come up and say, they got Measure 37. Let's do this to them. Let's take away transferability. They'll kick them in the rear. We couldn't believe it that someone so devious could come up with something like that. Because are you telling me all of your properties isn't transferable? It sure is. It's just a kick in the butt. I tell you, there's just devious people out there that we're just simple people, and we just don't think this way. You know, each day of life is a gift, and we should love, live, and laugh in it, and have a good life. and not be devious and try and see how you can stomp on someone's face and take away their rights. My husband has 21 years in the military. I'm very proud of him. We've worked very hard for our dream. And by God, we're not going to give up. Now, another thing, we have our absolute treasure of a lady in Oregon, 94-year-old Dorothy English, and she's waiting for you. She's waiting for you to make a decision, and we're looking at you and we're watching you. Real quick, I'd like to thank Bill Garrard and Dennis Richardson. When we testified the first and last time, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, along with lots of other people, about land fairness, getting it back, Bill Garrard and Dennis Richardson co-authored Measure 3315. It was simply stated, give people back their property rights that were in place when they bought it. It was simple, straightforward. It passed the Republican House immediately, went to the Senate. You know what happened there? They hit it, they killed it. This could have been over a long time ago. But these lawyers have taken in big checks, and you're telling us that we might have to appeal and pay lawyers again? I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Do something. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Pretty. Mr. Dean. And the next three, so when the time comes after these remarks, will be Brett Veach, Jonathan Araka, and Jeff Hunter. Go ahead, Mr. Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Dean. I live at 653 Scenic Heights Drive Southeast in Salem, Oregon. And first I would like to say that I did vote for Measure 37. It was sold to me by an aging property owner named Dorothy English as a method to fix unfair building restrictions that were placed on longtime property owners. It's clear now that its real objective was to create a loophole in the existing land use laws and allow indiscriminate development of forest and farmland. Just two days ago, a conceptual and detail approval was granted to a Measure 37 applicant to develop 217 acres adjacent to my property. During the hearing process, I and dozens of my neighbors provided extensive testimony in attempt to protect our limited reserves of domestic well water and the water source of our community lake and our rural livability. We received minimal in return for our efforts, and to appeal this decision we must spend more of our money and we must pay to have our wells monitored, and still this may not be enough. I would like to conclude by saying that the many property owners and farmers in our area have already spent a great deal of time and thousands of dollars defending ourselves and our investments from individuals who are misusing the system to reap huge profits at the expense of the environment and adjacent property owners. I urge you to place an immediate hold on all Measure 37 claims, including all those already approved, until a solution acceptable to all Oregonians can be found. Thank you very much.
Senator Brzozinski.
Yes, Ms. Pretty, I just want to let you know, based on the issue that you raised about Dorothy English, this legislature 2 years ago actually cleared her out of the state system. She has an issue that's in front of Multnomah County. 2 days ago, I received a press release that stated that the Multnomah County will be voting on an ordinance that will give her relief on February 15th. So it's up in Multnomah County. Hopefully they'll do the ordinance.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Okay, and as I indicated before, the next panel is Brett Veach, Jonathan Araka, if I'm pronouncing that right, and Jeff Graca, I'm sorry, and Jeff Hunter. And while they're coming forward, I'd like to thank all of these, particularly these early witnesses who came a longer distance than 100 miles to be here. It shows your commitment to the process that we're engaged in, and we really appreciate your going to this effort in order to give us your thoughts.
Oh, in federal. When I was in law school,
okay, so there are two of you.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, I didn't come more than 100 miles. So,
oh, I'm sorry.
You're misreading that.
And I'm saying, are you Brett?
I'm Brett.
Okay. Well, it says, do you live more than 100 miles from this meeting location?
Then I mismarked that box. So.
I see. Well, if you don't mind, then excusing yourself, and that'll give us room for then the seat, three seats at the
A table there.
Well, there were three.
That was Hood River.
So we have Jonathan Graca and Jeff Hunter.
That's that useful?
That's correct.
That's okay. Correct.
Graca.
My name is Jonathan Graca, and I'm the executive director of the Hood River Valley Residents Committee. And Hood River Valley Residents Committee is a 501c3 nonprofit engaged in promoting good land use policies. Established in 1977, today we are composed of about 200 farmers, business people, and concerned citizens working to educate and defend the conservation of resource land for resource uses. Today, agriculture is the engine of Hood River Valley's economy. It is responsible for 1 in 4 jobs, over $70 million in revenue, and even in its worst year, is still far and away the most lucrative revenue generator in the county. While profitable, there are still problems with farming in the county. A lack of workers due to tightening immigration policies, competition with foreign fruit, and the price of farmland are amongst some of the greater challenges to the industry. Measure 37 was advertised to help farmers, and it will help farmers in Hood River County. The 232 claimants stand to make millions off of claims. In doing so, they could take the whole ship down with them, though. Currently, there are 232 claims representing some 10,500 acres, and we have a map of that over here. This includes 25 to 30% of the valley's fruit trees. That's nearly 17 square miles, or 12% of all private county lands. Many say their intent is not to develop, but I'm not sure if this is the truth, and I don't think anybody will know until it's too late. Removing one-third of the farmland and installing thousands of second homes and golf courses presents three irreconcilable problems. For one, it could prevent existing farmers from carrying out normal farming practices. Second, farming is based on economies of scale. Hood River Valley currently has 3 packing houses. Farmers band together to process, market, and transport their product. Losing one of the packing houses could result in the already small and highly innovative farming community reaching a breaking point and become too small to work. Third, farming is about long-term investments. If the outlook for farming is looking more and more dire, farmers will not invest in new equipment, technologies, and innovation that Hood River farmers have become known for. Measure 37 is unfair. We support a temporary moratorium on approval of claims and construction to make sure Measure 37 is implemented in a fair and balanced manner. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Clem.
Just one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know if, Jonathan, thank you for coming. Would you be available to assist those of us, which I think is just about all of us on this side of the dais, on the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee in trying to help improve the farm economy? You mentioned challenges, profitability. Those are things that are very real, and I read an article about 3 years ago that said we may lose one packing house anyway just due to the fact that people can't make a living. Multiple challenges. This is one of them. Can you assist the Ag Committee as we work on some of the policies that help make farming viable again?
I think I could, and I think the members of the Residents Committee would be, could be very helpful. I'm not a farmer myself, but there are several members of our board and members of the Residents Committee that would surely like to help out.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Hunter.
Thank you. I'd like to just follow up on that we've discussed the needs of farmers a lot more as this has come up, and we've had to deal with this.
Mr. Hunter, even though I've called you by name, you should identify yourself for the record.
Jeff Hunter, Hood River Valley Residents Committee board member. It's national security. This is truly national security. And our concern, the reason we're here tonight, is Measure 37, as it is written now, threatens agriculture in Hood River Valley. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at that map. Most of those claims are on farmland. Measure 37 didn't pass by accident. There is real grievance underneath that, and we understand that there needs to be transferability. Claimants, especially claimants, most of them are older, and they need relief now. Not a year from now, not another long round of court battles. They need it now. Rural property owners need more options for economic benefits for their lands. We understand that. Private property is the issue that we're really arguing about underneath all of this. And we wanted to say that founding fathers saw a balance between rights and responsibilities. And sometimes that's getting lost from the debate today. Rights and responsibilities. There really are three key aspects to private property, at least in our 213-year history as a republic here. Quiet enjoyment. This is where the neighbors come in. To have a huge subdivision go into a rural setting is the end of quiet enjoyment for the neighbors who, in good faith, bought that land with land use laws in place to protect them. The bundle of rights, of course, and then the last thing is the good of the greater community. And this is where we come to you to ask you to be brave and deal with this problem now, because there is nobody else to fix it. We've seen what courts do. Courts simply, we've already got contradictory decisions a year into this, and it's going to get worse. So courts are not the answer to this this problem. And we've also seen the problem with the initiative process.
Ms. Hunter, if we could conclude it here.
I'll conclude.
If we could.
The initiative process hasn't worked as well either. So we feel that a moratorium is in order now to give time before vesting occurs. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And our first on the next panel is actually somebody who did not indicate having come from more than 100 miles, but also wrote Pendleton on the, which by my calculation is well more than 100 miles. Gary Reinhart is, Mr. Reinhart, did you come more than 100 miles? Yeah, you're up next. Okay. And then to join him, let's have, I have a Kerry Perry who marked over 100 miles, but also indicates Clackamas, and that's, by my calculation, less than 100 miles. So unless Kerry thinks that the it's more than 100, we'll skip over that.
It seems like that with traffic.
There you go. And I have also David Weil and Dick Day who indicated more than 100 miles. Are they here and did come more than 100 miles? I don't see them coming forward. So they would be the this would be our only, our last of our distant travelers. Whenever you're ready, please start by identifying yourself.
Well, when I left Pendleton today at 11 o'clock, it was snowing. We haven't seen the snow or seen the sun there in about 3 weeks, and it was kind of nice to come down here and see the sun. I actually have two statements here, two testimonies. A friend of mine actually asked me to read his testimony into the record. Can I do that?
It's not necessary since we've received it. It will be part of the record.
Okay.
And that would just, we'll all review everything that is handed in to us. So if you can give us your testimony, that would be great.
Okay, I'll just give my testimony and that's it. My name is Gary Reinhart. I live at 1914 Southwest Sunset Drive, Pendleton, Oregon. I'm a fourth generation dry land wheat farmer on lands I'm proud to say were homesteaded in 1860 by my family. I am asking the Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness to suspend Measure 37 immediately. I believe the true intention of the measure was to permit landowners to construct a single-family home on property they have owned for a long time. It was not intended to provide for large developments. In my service as chair of the Umatilla Basin Watershed Council and vice chair of the Umatilla County Planning Commission, I have listened carefully to many citizens of Umatilla County. Many are concerned that Measure 37 has turned into something very different than what the voters approved. Measure 37 raises numerous serious concerns for the citizens of Oregon. I will respect your time and address only a few. Rural-urban conflict. Measure 37 does nothing to address the impact to adjoining property owners and their rights to preserve an existing way of life. There are multiple claims filed in EFU lands that adjoin my farm, and many others are in the same situation. The protection of the century-old right to farm from the adverse effects of urban development commands equal protection. Fair compensation under Measure 37 cannot possibly exist when claimants establish the loss of value. The unfortunate reality is that Measure 37 holds county and state governments hostage. They have no choice or reasonable alternative than to granting all waivers. A value example is Wyland Ranches, which happens to be my cousin that farms right next to me, a request over $14.5 million for compensation on 1,366-acre partial, or over $10,000 an acre over the value of the property. This is over 10 times the value of comparable partials that have recently been sold near the property. Urban growth boundary expansion. Measure 37 has the potential to restrict the urban growth boundary expansion when need cannot be established to support growth due to excessive inventory of available lots. It impacts infrastructure expansion between city and counties, creating tremendous cost burdens for the cities and counties. It requires protection of EFU land that may be better suited for development, yet do not qualify under Measure 37.
Mr. Reinhardt, I know you've come a long way, but we're somewhat over the 2 minutes we were urging people, so if it's possible to summarize the remaining rather than read it, because we have the text of it in front of us.
30 years ago, Oregon was a courageous leader. It promised to protect its precious land resources for future generations. It is our responsibility to ensure that that legacy continues. I am confident that you will take immediate action to protect our state and its citizens through amendment or suspension of Measure 37. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Reinhardt. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I understand you correctly that the claim that you're contesting is your cousin's?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, some of these Measure 37 claims out there, you know, they're family members, and I can tell you right now that several of my family members voted for Measure 37. I didn't. They would not vote for it now. I can also tell you that being on the Planning Commission and being involved with the Measure 37 claims, we have, when our county commissioners notify all adjoining neighbors, they hold public hearings. Virtually nobody but people that oppose those claims come to those meetings. And most of the guys submitting the claims don't even come. They're scared to come. They send their attorneys and their real estate guy to handle it.
That's a lot of land use hearings, so I know what you're saying. If I could really quickly, one lesson.
Yeah.
The other testimony you submitted here is from somebody who bought a four-acre parcel living out in the country and now doesn't want four-acre parcels living out in the country?
No, he's living...
Says here,
yes, Carl Sheeler. Some of you might know Carl and Elizabeth Sheeler. She ran for Senate here in Pendleton a few years ago. But they bought this piece of property.
They bought 4 acres.
It was 4 acres.
That's all I want to know. I just want to make sure I understood that correctly.
And it was zoned over 40 years ago.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understood the context upon which.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, are these the two gentlemen whose names I called earlier?
Yes.
Yes, David Weil and Dick Day.
Yeah.
And you did come more than 100 miles to get here?
No, I did not. I don't know how that was.
Okay, well, then you should excuse yourself because you're at the end of the list. We haven't had a lot of people sign up before you. I'm sorry. But
well, we're right.
This is the Land Use Fairness Committee, and we're trying to be as fair as we can about the order in which we hear people. We're going to go back to the top of the list for those who did not come more than 100 miles. And the first three names are Roger K., Laurel Hines, and Jim Gilbert. And I see Roger K. and Laurel Hines signed up on a single block. And so if one of you is the spokesperson, that would work very well for us.
Separate.
Okay.
Nice trying.
Okay.
It might work well for us about that.
Good evening, chairs, co-chairs, and members of the committee. My name is Roger Kay. I'm current president, Friends of Marin County. I submitted a two-page brief on this for this hearing tonight. We favor suspension and actually revocation of Measure 37. You've heard a lot of that from other groups, but In particular, I want to discuss some other issues. You'll see a brief of Measure 37 claims in Marin County, 437 claims, 16,000 acres, that's about 28 square miles. One-third of the Measure 37 claims involve areas designated in sensitive groundwater overlay. This is basically groundwater-limited areas as designated by the Department of Water Resources. And basically, the concentration of claims in and around communities take away the decision-making process from small towns. You've heard all of that. And I think Laurel's going to talk about health and safety issues, so I want to leave a little time for that in terms of groundwater-limited areas. But what we're seeing is counties are applying different standards to the same law. So counties really shouldn't be doing that. Health and safety issues as defined in Measure 37 is basically undefined, and it's leaving up to the counties the right to do that. And we don't think that's appropriate. That should be set at the state level. And I also serve on the Marion County Planning Commission. You just heard a remark about a subdivision that was approved. In another case, I have another case where a threat is made by an applicant's attorney that if their approval is not approved on a land division and a partition, they will go and file a Measure 37 claim. So Measure 37 claim is being used as a hammer to force planning departments to approve claims that shouldn't be approved, basically under threat of this Measure 37 claim. And if you want to see that particular comment, I have a copy of that from their attorney. I have it right here. So I'll allow Laurel Hines to finish up if they have any questions.
Very good. Ms. Hines.
My name is Laurel Hines, and I live on Lake Drive, south of Salem. And besides being a member of Friends of Marion County, I'm kind of the organizer and chairperson, I guess you'd say, of a group called Keep Our Water Safe Committee. And I represent a group of homeowners, property owners that live in the Jefferson, South Salem Hills area adjacent to the Ankeny Wildlife Refuge. And we've been fighting one of the earliest major subdivisions on 217 acres of farmland near where we live, adjacent to where we live. And there's also at least three or four other claims surrounding the Ankeny Wildlife Refuge. So we're very concerned about these sort of urbanized subdivisions that are proposed for viable farmland. In the case that we're fighting, a farmer that farms the adjacent property stated that he had tried to farm that property three times, and he talked about what valuable farmland it was for vineyards or Christmas tree farms. Our group of citizens has spent a large amount of money trying to fight this subdivision that we feel threatens our groundwater, because we are in a groundwater limited area, and a lot of people in our area have already had significant well problems. I recently attended a seminar or a presentation by Todd Jarvis. He's a senior researcher at OSU's Water Resources Program, and he laid out the threat that Measure 37 poses to the groundwater limited areas and areas that haven't even been designated as limited and probably are limited in Oregon. And he talked about how Measure 37 claims, if nothing has changed, could result in 2 to 3 times as many exempt rural household wells as currently exist in the state in Oregon, which would be a huge burden to the groundwater, and that some areas of basalt groundwater have already declined, I think he said, something like 60 feet on average over the past 40 years. So we have some really, really significant groundwater problems happening in Oregon, and the Water Resources Department can't do anything about those until the problem is severe and probably irreversible. And that's when they step in to try and ameliorate the problem and work out all the difficulties.
Ms. Hines, we're beyond the two minutes we were urging people. So
can I just make a summary statement?
Yeah, if you could, please.
Okay. Global climate change is now a certainty. There's a big report coming out apparently tomorrow from 100 experts around the world. Measure 37 will severely worsen the problem for Oregon's declining groundwater areas. If Measure 37 is not repealed, there at least needs to be some kind of limit on large subdivisions in farm and forest land. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hines. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think anybody knows this, but I'm also a rural resident who lives in a area of farm and forest zone land, but I don't farm the land I live on. It's a small, very small parcel, probably similar to what most of the Friends of Marion County are situation. There's a very large Measure 37 claim right next to my house. My well is only 7 gallons a minute and goes down during the summer. I'm actually personally in the situation. I'm just having a hard time understanding my mind why it is that the Friends of Marion County are taking such a hard stand. It seems like we're living the rural lifestyle that we all enjoy, and other people want to enjoy that. How can we not kind of find some middle ground? You talk about a repeal of Measure 37. It seems like to me that if you guys would soften your position a little bit, work with the neighbors, say, hey, how can we possibly work through this together so other people can enjoy the exact kind of lifestyle you enjoy? I mean, I feel very guilty about my neighbor. It may cause me problems, but he has the right to enjoy his property and put in some houses where other people can enjoy the same rural lifestyle I enjoy. And I'm more than willing to work with them, even though it may affect my well. I'm having a hard time. How come Friends of Marion County can't work with that neighbor and say, sure, these people want to have the same lifestyle we do and not close the door behind us?
May I respond
sure.
to that? Well, the area that we live in is a very ravined and hilly area. Most of the area that the acreage residential areas that are nearby this farmland that wants to be a subdivision. And it's very treed and ravined and really is unfarmable, basically, without bulldozing many, many trees. And I think the geohazard issues would prohibit any kind of farming there, basically. We're the areas that the land use laws has designated as acreage residential areas, which are seen as poor value for farmland. Whereas this Measure 37 claim we're fighting is basically two mostly barren hills that would be ideal for farming. Very little would have to be done to it for farming.
But I'm just asking what the person has a claim. The person has a claim. Clearly, they got hurt by the system. If you could work with them, it seems like to me that you might be able to come up with a much more equitable solution than just saying no to your neighbor. I mean, I'm in the same situation you are, and my reaction is completely different than yours. I want to work with my neighbor, figure out how I possibly can allow people to have the same kind of lifestyle I want to have, which is rural, residential, and it's forest land right next to me. I'm having a hard time understanding your perception saying close the door behind you after you have exactly what you're trying to fight. I'm having a hard time with that.
I think a good example of this is the Victor Point area near Silverton, where landowners were seeing a severe decline in their groundwater over a period of years. I'll get to it. And what happened is that they tried to fight different subdivisions, nothing happened, and their groundwater declined so much that people started reaching salinity in their water, which made it unusable.
I worry about that all the time. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, but I worry about that all the time myself, but I'm still having a hard time. I'm in the same situation you are, and I'm understanding why can't you work with them?
Senator George, we're going to probably hear a lot of various perspectives from multiple witnesses, so I think maybe dialoguing with individual members of the public while others are waiting may be less productive. For example, it's important that we cover the question, but
It's about water, and it may be that she may be the one who's got the answer for me.
Okay,
I'm sorry, and if not, just quickly divert it. We'll get somebody else up at another time. Just, am I getting this right? The Oregon Water Resources Division, or whatever it's called, they aren't part of the process at the time of even LCD or DLCD looking at whether or not there's a health and safety issue because of the water?
They can designate an area as groundwater limited, but the counties are the only ones that have the power to restrict development until there's a really, really severe water problem declared. And then the state water resources can declare it I can't remember the exact designation of a critical groundwater area, and then all development has to stop until they find a solution to that. In the Victor Point area, for example, they're only a mile and a half or a mile from Silverton, and they had to get water piped in from Silverton, and it cost each of them something, I think it was $14,000 to $16,000 to do that after already having drilled you know, more than one well on some of the properties and deepening many wells. We live about 6 miles from Salem, which would make that prohibitive.
Right.
So we would just be without water.
Mr. Chair, maybe another time when Director Shetterly comes up or after all the public testimony, someone from Water Resources to talk about their view on this down the road.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Gilbert.
Yes, well, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, it's an honor to be here tonight and testify regarding Measure 37. In my opinion, Measure 37 is one of the most important issues facing our state. And
Mr. Gilbert, could you just identify yourself for the record?
Jim Gilbert. My name is Jim Gilbert. I own and operate Northwoods Nursery in One Green World near Molalla, Oregon. And being that Measure 37 is so important to our state, I think it's really no overstatement to say that the future of Oregon, the future success of Oregon agriculture and the fate of what we all value about our state, much of what we value about our state is in your hands, and I greatly appreciate the hard work you're doing to resolve this difficult issue. I've owned and operated my nursery business since 1982 in southern Clackamas County. I grow a broad range of nursery stock, focusing primarily on fruiting plants. And we all have talked about some of the uncertainties of agriculture in Oregon and how important it is to our economy. As farmers, we deal with issues of we can't control the weather, we have pest problems, possibly marketing our crops and other things. But I've always felt that the one thing that was I felt comforted and secure in was that our land use laws at least allowed me to feel that urban development would not threaten my water supplies. I need to grow my crops, that I would not have conflict with my neighbors over my farming practices, and that the agricultural region in which I live would remain intact, giving me access to the supplies and equipment necessary to do my work. And it was also important to know that affordable land existed so that I could expand my operation if necessary. So now Measure 37 has really cast a pall over the agriculture area I live in and has made the future of my farm and my neighbor's farms much less secure. You've heard from Clackamas County Commissioner Lynn Peterson that over 25% of EFU land in Clackamas County is now subject to Measure 37 claims. I have one on my neighbor's land, and a recent map that just came out actually today in the Canby newspaper showed how many are just in our area alone. These claims threaten our water supplies, create conflicts between farmers and suburban residents, congest our already overtaxed roads that we need to transport our products, and greatly reduce the land available to grow our crops. You've heard some testimony about the subdivision claims will not materialize, landowners simply preserving their rights. And I see that differently, and I take no comfort in living next door to a potential gravel pit, strip mall, or subdivision, and for hundreds of houses to be built with all the negative impacts that that would mean for me. As many of you know, I also recently ran for state representative and talked to thousands of citizens from my rural district. And from those citizens and voters I spoke with, Measure 37 was about fairness. I spoke with many people about it, and many of the voters from Measure 37 did so because they wanted our land use laws to be fair, to allow a person the right to build a house on their land, even if they had that right before land use laws were implemented. Except for those who have actually filed Measure 37 claims, I didn't talk to one person who had in mind that Measure 37 would permit subdivisions, gravel pits, strip malls on farm and forest land.
Excuse me, Mr. Gilbert, we're a little over the 2 minutes here.
And I appreciate the struggle you've all had, you're having in resolving this issue. I wanted to support you in giving Measure 37 claims a timeout, so I took on a personal project, which was to circulate and receive signatures. I've received signatures from almost 1,500 Oregonians from around the state, from various walks of life. And, Mr. Co-Chairs, I would like to submit these petitions to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. The next three people on the sign-up list are Marilyn Reeves, David Bugney, I'm maybe murdering that pronunciation, and Deb Davis. And while they're coming forward, I'm going to announce a little procedural change. A number of the committee members have indicated they're willing to stay until 7:30 in order to hear more of those who came to give public testimony. And so there will be an opportunity to speak up until 7:30. That probably isn't enough to get to the end of the sign-up list this evening, however. And I will have to excuse myself here shortly. In fact, I'm going to turn the gavel over to the co-chair, Senator Przanski, here for the remainder of the proceedings.
Mr. Chair, Mr. New Chair, would it be possible to have one of those petitions passed around that just came in to take a look at during the proceedings.
We'll make that happen.
Thanks.
I'm not sure who was called up first. If you'll just give us your name and your testimony, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
My name's Marilyn Reeves. I live in Amity, outside of Amity in Yamhill County. I'd like to pick up on the discussion that you've just had in regard to groundwater. We know one thing about Measure 37. For those who complained that Measure 37 was confusing, caused all kinds of legal problems and costs, it has now been compounded more than anybody could ever imagine by Measure 37. So what people who complained about Measure 37 now have this overlay. And one of the most important unintended consequences which will affect state government deals with the issue of water resources. Okay. This state does not have the adequate laws or regulatory tools in its toolbox to prevent depletion of groundwater. That is a clear need for the future, regardless of what happens with Measure 37. So one of the clear unintended consequences of all of this, and I would urge and I would follow up with Representative Clem, please have a hearing and have a discussion with water resources people so you better understand that each resident in this state is automatically allowed to drill a well. And so in Yamhill County, if we have a 19-lot subdivision that comes before us, they can come in and have 19 wells, even though all of us would say that isn't good planning. In fact, in Yamhill County, subdivisions can be approved without any water. There is a provision in our land division ordinance that allows the county to just put a statement on the final plat that says no community water supply or wells is available for these lots. That is not responsible planning. And I would urge that as you look carefully at what to do about Measure 37, suspension is important. It'll provide a timeout, not only for the claims, but far more importantly, for the development, and particularly, we need time out for all of these rural subdivisions that are coming forth over 20-some-odd this year in Yamhill County, and I didn't count the ones from last year. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reeves. David, if you'll go ahead and please give us your full name.
My name's David Bugney, 30265 Southeast Cole Road, rural Estacada, Oregon.
Thank you.
And I just came before you, resubmitted a community letter to Representative Smith last week, and I just wanted to provide a couple perspective points about that just for a frame of reference. We live in very rural Estacada up in the George area, and all this area that's green, that's Longview Fiber Bureau land management land, so we, since it's timber country, that's pretty much what it is. Essentially, all landowners around here are timber owners or farmers, and we have several Measure 37 claims that we're concerned about. We've got some that are solid pink. Those are proposed one-acre subdivisions. The 1 acre, to give you a frame of reference, is that little black square right there. So there'd be a whole bunch of potential lots being created. Then we've got some that are a little smaller, and they're larger in acreage, but smaller in their claims as far as maybe 5 to 10 acre parcels. And then we've got some that are just two or three homes on a lot, which everybody supports, doesn't have any problem with that. But like I say, the concerns that we have are with the one-acre subdivisions and proposed subdivisions, and the concerns we have, again, surround groundwater. We are living in a groundwater-depleted area. We've got issues with, there's only one road into this place, and it's a loop mounted in the forest, is right here. And so this is it. It's a very windy, very primitive road. That's another concern we have. The other biggest concern we have is wildfire. Since most of us are rural timber owners, with increased densification like this, we're concerned that that may raise our wildfire potential. We had a pretty substantial wildfire down here in Longview Fiber territory last year. The closest urban growth boundary is Estacada. That's about 6 road miles away. As you can see from this map, there's nothing of any scale of 1 acre parcels at all. Most of them are in the 10, 20, 40, 80 acre size. There's some in 5 acres here, but that's about it. So we just urge you to consider the impacts of this to the common community, and all the folks that are here in blue on this map are the ones that signed that letter in front of you, and some that are off the map that didn't show up on here. And to really just think about what you're doing, and please consider the impacts on rural Oregonians like yourself. So, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Bev Davis.
Hi, my name is Bev Davis, and I live on Chehalem Mountain. It's outside of Newburgh. We've just been named part of the Oregon Wine Community. I live next to a Measure 37 claim. My concern for you is to really look at the issue of water. We live on a spring system up on our mountain. There are a numerous amount of springs. One is on the claimant's property, which they now get water from. There is a small one on my property. Then there's the major big spring is called Skeleton Spring that serves 68 people for the Water District of Newburgh, plus 5 families in the local area. This spring was last year, or the year before, was redone, and it was tested by Groundwater Solutions out of Portland, and it was not done for a Measure 37. It was done for the city of Newburgh because the people at the bottom of this 68 people that go down the mountain to get the water were complaining that by the middle of summer and late summer, they were not getting enough water out of the spring at all to do their lawns, their gardens, and they were not even getting enough water for normal water use. My concern is having 13 more homes or 12 more homes in this area, is it going to reduce the springs? The groundwater solution finding says that it will, and we have the letter from them that says it will lower the water table, and it could potentially reduce the flow of the spring. Already the homes at the top of the mountain, which we're not that far from, have already had to go in and drill their wells deeper. There are 2 families that live right above this proposed development that have wells, and they are very concerned that these 12 more houses on this system will drain down the water. Nobody can give us an answer on if all these springs are connected, if they all come from the same flow or not. When we went to the hearing before the 3 commissioners in Yamhill County, they recommended that they do a water study with a hydrologist. Today, by coincidence, I had a call from Dan Denisi of Newburgh Water District.
Ms. Davis, I want to ask you to please wrap up. It's been over 2 minutes.
And they had done their study, but it was on what they used to do for irrigation and not a real true, like, going down and making the well come forward and produce what would be enough for 12 more families. And I'm just asking, please help with the water situation. We don't want to lose our water, and neither does the town of Newburgh.
Thank you very much, all 3 of you, for your testimony. Michelle, I think it's Mickelson, Brad Sinicott, maybe, and Richard Joyce. The next 3, so you know who's coming up next, will be Kathy Magar, and it looks like Richard and Kathleen Hasselbacher. And then while y'all are getting set, I'm going to tell 2 people, Scott Ashcom and for Larry Wells, since y'all are, let's say, here in the Capitol a lot, you may realize that you may not be called on in the order that you're in, since we know that you can come back at another time if we're running late. So we may go ahead and get some other people that are here for one night. Mm-hmm. And go ahead and start.
My name is Michelle Michelson. I live at 18304 Northeast Bald Peak Road in Newburgh, Oregon. I wanted to come tonight so that you guys could see a face of who's being impacted by Measure 37 claim. I am a licensed and boarded veterinary technician. I own and operate Bald Peak Foaling and Rehabilitation Center, which is located adjacent to a Measure 37 claim. It is going to directly impact my livelihood. It's how I make a living. I currently advertise that I do rehabilitation and foaling in high-risk mares. It is imperative that it is kept quiet. I don't know if all of you have heard about the Barbaro horse, but those are the types of horses that I am working on. There's currently two rehab centers in the state of Oregon. Mine is the only one on the west side of the Cascades. Most all the horses, it's imperative that they stay quiet. Horses are a flight or fright animal. Any increased noise or commotion is going to delay healing, and it's going to directly impact clients bringing their horses to my facility. I currently lease 4 acres of land from this claimant and have been issued letters of intimidation from him that if I came and opposed at any further meetings that I would have consequences. I'm wanting to know why I was allowed to lease this land from him with no indication that there was going to be a claim. The lease is in existence for another 2 years with an option of 5 years after that. How is he going to be developing this land when there are current horses on it? I would like to address Senator George really quick and answer his question why other people should be allowed to come and enjoy what we enjoy. I purchased my property 21 years ago, 20 acres. It was zoned AF20 at the time. I was a college student. I worked 6.5 days a week and worked 2 jobs so that I could afford the 20-acre minimum that was required. If the claimant next door wished to put 1 or 2 more houses on a 20-acre minimum, we wouldn't have a problem with that. It would not impact our rural community. But I advertise this in my brochure, and I am receiving horses from licensed veterinarians all across the state of Oregon, California, Idaho, Washington, and if they're not going to send them to a housing development, these horses aren't going to heal. High-risk mares are going to have problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Brad?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Brad Senecut. I live at 13701 Northeast Haps Lane in Newburgh. I am speaking in opposition to a moratorium. I am a Measure 37 applicant. Our family purchased some property in 1960, a family corporation, and we have documented in our corporate minutes that the intention was to develop or to allow family members to have 10-acre parcels for residences if they chose to do so. And since then, that door has been closed because of the land use laws that came up afterwards. I just wish that could continue. I think there's been a lot of talk tonight about the unintended consequences of Measure 37. I don't want the committee to forget the intended consequences of Measure 37. Mm-hmm. I agree that there are a lot more issues coming up, the number of claims, and perhaps some more study is necessary. But for those of us that have had our claims in, I'd like for you to allow us the due process, to allow those to continue, instead of being just a few days short of our 180-day wait period and then being shut down. Like there are other applicants, some of us may not live long enough for the process to become perfect. I think the claim is a work in motion. It does need work, but you can't unwind it. I think you just go forward and make improvements of it. We don't want to, you can unwind all the wrongs in our country all the way back to the Constitution and Bill of Rights, but we don't want to do that. You've got to say, draw a line and say, okay, we're going to do this from now on, but allow whatever's been happening to continue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, are you taking any questions?
Not at this point. Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Dick Joyce, Richard Joyce from Sherwood, Oregon, or west of Sherwood. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. My comments are going to be very personal. In fact, I'm not particularly happy about bearing my soul in front of so many people, and they're certainly not here to garner sympathy, but to lay out what happened as a matter of fairness a long time ago. Fairness so far seems to be complaints for people who don't want to see new houses or perhaps something else move in. close to their farm. But the lack of fairness when the changes were that came about when this Measure 37 was imposed, I think was pretty severe too. In my particular area, they overlaid a farm zone over areas that met all the criteria of committed and developed. But the county at that time had about 80 or 90 people in the Planning Commission. I could not get one of them come out and drive the neighborhood to see what was committed and developed. Had it been treated that way at that time, the issues never would have come up. Results, I lost, with my small farm, I lost about $1.5 million of net worth immediately, just like that. What had been about an 18% levered business went to 60% again, just like that. The people that held my notes were very nervous when it goes over 50% to call the notes. I paid everybody off, sold nearly 100 acres to pay them off, but still had to go into a Chapter 12 bankruptcy to keep people at bay, and paid everybody 100% off. Fairness didn't seem to apply at that point. A greatly reduced price in order to have money to live. Many, many farmers around me lost their places or had to quit farming that were what is now my age now. In my case, I ultimately sold, as I said, the property to come out right. I paid off all my obligations, but still, of course, took the hit from terrible credit that never seems to leave you. My farmer friends who were further out from urban, committed, and developed areas did not have this financial hit because their land was valued for farmland, which it was. So my point is that one size does not fit all. And that's exactly what happened with this law, is that one size fit all. This overlay was obviously a mistake. We tried to get it solved. The county tried to solve it. Every time they approached a solution, our friends would step in either politically or with threat of suits. So the counties basically had to lie down, and little was ever fixed. 30 years later, Measure 7, Measure 37, you've heard the whole litany. Marion County judge, a strange opinion by the Oregon's Attorney General, and we are where we are.
Mr. Joyce, I
certainly wish that my wife had lived long enough to enjoy what I'm hoping to, and I think that's part of the motive for asking for moratoriums.
Mr. Joyce, if you can get your wrap-up.
Thank you. That's it.
I'm going to let the panel, if you have one question, and because we would like to get more. I think, excuse me, Senator George, did you have a question that you want to follow up?
Well, if I could, Mr. Joyce, you made a point that I tried to make earlier that's really important for people to understand, is that what the land use laws did to real farmers who were trying to farm in the 1980s by putting so many of them out of business who were leveraged just similar to what you were, and it was really a tragedy. And one of the things that strikes me right now is that when we're talking about fairness, we have to talk about that people have expectations, and I appreciate you coming tonight because it really brings up a case that exactly what my family faces similar situations, you know.
I live on one edge of the mountain. She lives on the other. I could name a dozen families in between that lost their places or took that trip.
I grew up with a lot of their kids, so it affected my life. I appreciate you coming.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. To Mr. Sennacott, you oppose a moratorium. Let me ask you this. If there was a process in place that would put a moratorium on some of the giant developments, but provide a methodology for you and your family that want 1, 5, 4 houses on, I don't know how much acreage you have or how many houses you're looking for. What would be your reaction to that?
I'd like to clarify, as far as imposing a moratorium on applications that are close to already being fulfilled, I'm not saying that maybe you need one in the future, or a conditional one for the large, huge things, you know. Maybe make the ones that are a little bit more straightforward. We have 160 acres, or 167 acres, so we're looking at 10 if we want to do it. We're not saying we want to do it, but we'd like to have the right to.
Thank you. Thank you, each of you, for being here. The next panel, please come up. And again, that was Kathy Mager and Richard and Kathleen Hasselbacher. And the next panel will be John Crew, Sarah Dimling, and Brett Beach. Thank you. Have you identified yourself?
I'm Kathy Mazar. I'm John Q. Public, and I vote. And I'm glad to be here at the fair use committee for land. So I looked up fair in the dictionary, and it said it was free from bias, dishonesty, or injustice. So I looked up bias. The definition was bias means prejudice. I looked up justice, and that means a moral right. Well, I own 5 acres of land that's essentially a ravine close to Newburgh. 2 areas of this ravine are flat enough for a house or a trailer. Bought it in 1963. From that time to this time, due to government bureaucracy and who knows what, all our little regulations, that ravine is without value at all. Can't put any little trailer or anything on it. So there it sits. It is in wildlife deferral. It's good for the wildlife. But if you put a house or two there, it would still be in wildlife deferral. It would still be good for the wildlife. Well, I work at Emmanuel Hospital. And there's a young fella that's a transportation aide there that's worked there for 10 years. This kid was born in the gutter in northeast Portland, and he pulled himself out of that gutter. He pulled himself out of drugs and guns and gangs. He now has a wife and a little daughter, and he's doing very well. He has to live in an apartment, though. He cannot afford an acre of land in the country for his family. Why can't he afford it? Because 1,000 Friends of Oregon have made sure people like that don't get a break. They can't move out into our beautiful country. The neighbors live in this beautiful houses surrounded by vineyards, but they wouldn't want to look at his little trailer messing up their landscape. Anyhow,
Mayor,
he can't build a house or put a trailer on there, yeah, even if I gave him the land. Am I over time?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you. And Richard or Kathleen, whoever wants to go first.
My name is Richard Hasselbacher, and my wife, Kathleen. I voted for Measure 37. I'm in favor of property rights, but I have a personal situation in which we have a family farm. A claim was filed by my mother and my father. My father just died 12 days ago. He was basically coerced into signing on to the claim. His wishes were to never sell the farm with the intent to keep it in the family and hand it on down. I'm the fourth generation. I currently operate 19 acres of nursery stock, operate the landscape maintenance and a spray service out of there. And the mother and a brother are proceeding ahead with this claim. They want to put 59 one-acre parcels on the property with no concern for my livelihood, plus 2 of the lessees that are also on the property. So even though I'm in favor of Measure 37, I would like to see the brakes put on this till we could resolve that issue.
Thank you. And Kathleen, did you have anything that you would like to add?
I would say that we are we stand in line with the man from Pendleton who's on the Planning Commission over there. We could agree with almost everything that he has had to say. This Measure 37 is out of hand, and people like us who want to continue farming and really don't, at this point, we don't care about the money. It's the farming. It's the lifestyle that we have that we want to continue. So with that in mind, I just want to say that a lot of consideration needs to be given to folks like us who, fourth generation farming, want to continue that without impeding the neighbors. There's neighbors out. We're in the middle of Hazel Green, you know, and that's just out of Salem.
Yes, ma'am.
But it's still in the middle of farmland. This was FU.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The next panel.
Can I add one thing real fast?
Sure.
Real fast. I just want to say, you know, this kid, there's a million like him, and he needs a break. He needs to be able to buy some land. And as long as we have all these regulations, it'll be beyond him.
Thank you again.
Fairness.
All right, so the next panel I've called up, if you would be so kind, John Cruz, Sarah Dingling, and Brett Beach. The next panel will be Ralph Johnson, Richard Table, it looks like, and then John Wimmer. John, if you want to start.
Hi, I'm John Crew from Newburgh, Oregon. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I'm here on behalf of my parents, who currently have a Measure 37 claim. They already have preliminary approvals from both Yamhill County and the state of Oregon. My parents bought their property in 1965 with the intention of someday subdividing and selling 2.5-acre lots to subsidize their retirement. In the 1970s, land use laws were put in place, making it not possible to subdivide. last year, Measure 37 was voted in by the voters of Oregon and became law. My parents have spent the majority of their retirement savings on required road engineering, drainage engineering, hydrologist studies, geologist studies, road permits, septic test holds, surveying, application fees and permits at state and county levels. It would be incredibly unfair at this point to stop Measure 37 claims that are this far along without compensation. Their expenses incurred going forward on a Measure 37 claim, which is a valid law in the books right now, will be devastating to their retirement savings if they are not either compensated or allowed to complete the subdivision and sell the lots. The opponents are talking about lack of water. My parents had a hydrologist look at the water situation for their area. My parents used to irrigate nearly half of the property. The hydrologist report showed that the gallons of irrigation usage is 5 times more than the proposed 11 new homes would use. Some opponents are complaining about losing farmland, but cities all over are paving over prime farmland on a daily basis. Is it okay for cities to do it, but not for a few landowners to develop? That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. And Sarah. Brett.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brett Beach, also from Newburgh, Oregon. I'll try to keep my comments brief, as most of it's already been touched upon already. I'd like to mention just a few things. The rights underneath Measure 37 are a backwards look. You must take into consideration the fact that what people lost at one point in time, such as Mr. Crew, also such as my wife's family. My wife's family had a piece of property. They wanted to divide it up amongst the children. A zone change came along. They were unable to do so. And actually, just prior to the passage of Measure 37, the family member that would qualify as a claimant passed away, and there was no ability to do that. So you've got 4 children now on one piece of property trying to figure out how to manage it amongst them. So you have to take a look and make sure that you don't just take into consideration what the effects might be in the future, but what has already transpired to those people in the past. I see Measure 37 as having several different classifications. Those folks that have already got land use approvals in the works or already approved, those folks that have pending claims, and those folks who have yet to file. Obviously, the folks that have already got approved claims or approved land use decisions, any change in the law at this point in time would cause them irreparable harm. So I can't see anything being done to those folks, and they should probably be exempt from anything. So those are my comments.
Thank you very much. And Sarah, I apologize. If we can get the microphone, just
Sarah,
kind of.
Sarah, do there I go. 4550 Oak Grove Road, Rick Rial, Polk County. Well, in my 60 years of being an Oregonian, Measure 37 is the worst thing that's happened to Oregon. I'm the mother of 4, grandmother of 2, grew up on a big farm in Clackamas County, which is still a farm. I now own and manage forest land in Polk County,
six generations of Oregonians that have been contributing to the prosperity of Oregon for all those years. Many people I know who voted for Measure 37 thought they were voting to give longtime landowners the right to build a house on their property, which seems perfectly reasonable, even two houses for children. What we have are thousands of acres scheduled for subdivisions randomly scattered across our irreplaceable farm and forest land. Windfall profits for a few on the backs of rural farm and forest neighbors in the entire state. The forest I manage was bought in the 1980s under a set of land use laws that led us to believe that we could practice forestry over the long term. And forestry is, by definition, a long-term proposition. Now we are surrounded by Measure 37 claims, the most egregious of which is for 54 dwellings on domestic wells along our entire southern boundary, and then 8 houses, 4 houses, 19 houses all around, and hundreds more in the groundwater limited area of the Eola Hills just west of Salem. The county, this is a little footnote, notifies in EFU land people within 750 feet. Which is fine under the old rules. Under the Measure 37 system, it means only a tiny fraction of the people who are impacted by this land use request are notified. So it turns out that I feel I'm representing dozens of people who weren't notified and only found out because of an effort on my part at the last minute that in this groundwater limited area where many of the wells are very deep and inadequate, all of these houses on, well, there are hundreds of houses planned on domestic wells, which can pump, without a permit, 15,000 gallons a day. So I would reaffirm the suggestion that talking to the Department of Water Resources would be very important.
If you can wrap up, that'd be wonderful.
I'll be quick. We can't allow hunting in a subdivision. We have increased fire danger. We have trespass, chainsaws, trees falling. We're a tiny example of what's going on in the state. I would say moratorium on anything more than a house or two, and the mom and pops who've waited all these years should definitely have their house or two. And I need to say that every acre of farm and forest land and open space that falls to the bulldozer is one more acre which will never again produce cherries or wheat or grapes or forest products or capture carbon dioxide or protect a spring or be a home to native plants and animals.
That
and every development will reduce the options that our children have.
All right.
It's selfishness. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next panel is Ralph Johnson, Richard I.
Taubel,
it looks like, and John Wimmer.
I guess report did this.
As they're coming up, the panel that's going to be after them, it looks like it's Karen Wade, and then Harry Vanderpool, and Carrie Perry. And if Ralph would be so kind to start off, that'd be great.
I'm Ralph Johnson. I live at 16705 Northeast Shehalem Drive, Newburgh. And we bought our property in 1956 and I was raising turkeys. Got trouble with the turkeys. I had to either sell out or move. And I decided to do something different. I started selling real estate. In 1969, I got our property zoned 1 acre to be used as our retirement. And then come along Senate Bill 100, changed the zone to 40 acres. And being as I was a realtor and a turkey grower, I didn't have any PERS. So I kind of filed up my retirement. Then Measure 37 came along, and my retirement came back.
It's been an interim report or something.
June 6th, subdivision was approval, and we have invested quite a bit of money in engineering and surveys so far, and a lot of my personal time. Changing the law at this time would cause irreparable damage to the applicants financially as well as to the age of the landowners because many are in their 80s and above. I'm 80 and holding. not large developers looking for a windfall. We'd like to have our retirement back. Don't take our retirement from us again, as I will feel our government has lost every ounce of integrity it ever had. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard?
My name is Richard Tarwin. My address is 16780 Northeast Rush Road, Newburgh. I didn't have didn't plan on speaking. I'm not a speaker. But I got a little note here, so I think I'll let you know. I was going to send it out, that's why I can tell it to you right now. We bought our property in 1970 and moved the family there with a plan that after we get older, we'll have the kids take over, and then it goes from there on. That they changed the rules on us in 1971 and instead of two 10-acre parcels, we had one 20-acre parcel. Since then, we couldn't do anything with it. So we filed a 37 claim to divide our property in 20 acres and 5-acre parcels. We would like each of our three children to be able to build a home on their 5 acres. We have to take care of our grandchildren. Now, hopefully, they will help take care of us in the future. We spent thousands of dollars on permits, soil testing, engineering, and surveying, and hope that the legislature will not take our right away now after spending all this money and thing. It is our only savings we have. So we thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might point out, I'm not sure anybody who doesn't live in Newburgh isn't here tonight. I really appreciate the support of my constituents.
Mr. Wimmer.
Yes, John Wimmer. I live in the Joseph Street area in South Salem, southeast. Connects Route 22 east with Bombsville Highway in the area of Olson's Orchards. I'm here to speak on behalf of the Columbia Basalt Aquifer that is under our feet. One of the Marion County commissioners said the State Water Resources Department hadn't done enough in its view of assessing the groundwater situation in Marion County. Well, okay, but if you look at their budget, which comes out of the general fund, and their staffing, I think they've done the best job that they can. I'd like to propose that every new well that's drilled or bored in the state of Oregon have to receive a permit to do so, and that a fee be assessed. And the money from those fees go for testing, monitoring, exploration, whatever words there might be, wells, and in public education about our aquifer and groundwater supply, because if you study those areas, you'll be finding some interesting results. Two, in any development, and the government can decide how many houses would constitute government in sensitive water areas, that we show wet water, not paper water, not projections, actual water, and that water have to show some sort of condition that is viable for a residence in both the gallons per minute and the quality of the water itself.
Mr. Wimmer, I need you to wrap up, please.
Yes. 5 acres, I would like to see the average taken out of that for rural farmland, sensitive groundwater development, that it being strictly 5 acres per house. And that concludes my remarks.
Thank you all for being here. The next panel, again, is Karen Wade, Harry Vanderpool, and Carrie Perry. The next panel will be Dan Goffin, Fred Netter, and it looks like Carl, I think it's Dittweiler. And Karen, when you're ready, if you'd go ahead and identify yourself and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Karen Wade. I am a stakeholder in Measure 37.
And just some brief comments in regards to short term. I believe Measure 37 should be left alone. As the very beginning speaker spoke this evening, I went to the polls to vote. I cast and trust that what I read in the voter's pamphlet was what Measure 37 was all about. If we need to address the measure and the pamphlet, we need better guidance then. What I heard tonight is we still don't know or understand, or appeals may still happen. It's unresolved. But please don't continue to mislead us if you wish our trust. We have people who have already spent money on their appeals process, on the application process. What's going to happen to them? Now we're saying that an appeals may also happen, so I am again kind of reiterating some of those statements that were made earlier. And we can't file or place an application for Measure 37 or even represent ourselves unless we have a lawyer. Is that what this is really all about? It's all about costs in trying to hear our voices heard. So thank you for staying late this evening to allow a voice to be heard. A long-term suggestion is the fact that how do you measure Malheur County and their land growth with Multnomah County? I believe there should be some flexibilities within the counties to deal with their individual situations. I believe that in our own community where I live, I called our city and I asked them, do we have a 5-year plan? Do we have a 10-year plan? Do we have a 15-year plan? Do we have a 20-year plan? Our 20-year plan currently has no change. That's pretty disturbing for when you see growth growing all around you and there's been no efforts to look at a growth boundary and change. Also, in this same realm, within 3-year period, we have almost a small community just outside our city with a public golf course. How did that happen? It replaced farmland.
Ms. Wade.
Now we have another proposal for another huge development with high retail shops that's going to take out the orchards. I see discrimination. If you have money, you can get by. If not, we're like the Joe Low, and we're a low man on the totem pole.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Harry Vanderpool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. I got some pictures for you to look at. Might want to dim the lights down a little bit.
I think we can see them okay.
Oh, you can see it okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have 3 quick comments to make and some pictures to show you. If I can figure out how to advance this thing. There we go. I'm a commercial beekeeper out in Marion County, south of Salem. I move hives all the way down to California and all the way up to Madras, pollinating crops for farmers. And so comment number one, I'll just get through this quickly. Comment number one is I want to ask you all to not necessarily dismiss the small acreages that have some of these claims or the impacts to small acreages adjacent to these claims as being, that's only 15 acres. That's, you know, that we put a subdivision. No, you can't make a living on that. You can't make a living on 25 acres. You can't make a living on 30. You can make a living on all of those acres. You can make part of your living on those. As a commercial beekeeper, the majority of my accounts are 5 to 80 acres. A lot of them are 10 and 20 acres. People are making part of their living off of their parcels. Those parcels are very valuable. So there is the threat, in my mind, there is a threat to these small acreages just being dismissed as, well, we go ahead and develop those because, you know, they're not valuable. They're extremely valuable to Oregon specialty crops. Brings me into comment number two. And that is the indirect effect of Measure 37 claims. The following, I'm going to give you two paraphrased terms commonly used by counties in deciding a variance request, conditional use permit, or other land use applications that are not in a 37 claim. When you go to the county, which I've done and I've worked with the county, there would be language such as, the requested use may be permitted where it can be demonstrated that it will not have a negative impact upon the existing or potential farm or timber operations. Sounds reasonable. Here's another one. The proposed use will not materially alter the stability of the land use pattern of the area and surrounding zoning ordinance. Every county has its own phraseology similar to the above that is used in land use decision making.
Mr. Vanderpool, I'm going to need you to please wrap up.
Okay. Where is this language in Measure 37 claims? Where are the surrounding landowners left? I've been showing you pictures of my business. This is my full-time business. On 15 acres. This is specialty farming is what you're looking at here. See the fence line there? Measure 37 claim for a house per acre. Now, I don't think I need to say anything more about what I'm facing.
Thank you. Ms. Perry.
I'm Carrie Carey, and I'm the executive director and founder of Blue Heaven Therapeutic Riding Academy. We pair disabled people with seasoned horses for healing. And I've been talking with my clients and their families, and I have actually got a petition. Everybody signed it. And it was funny because I didn't think they would. You know, I thought probably they all voted for it. Well, they did. They all voted for it. None of them realized what it was. They thought it was Dorothy English, the, you know, 80-year-old lady who was the poor thing. And she was truly being disrespected, I believe. But people who don't even live on the property, they live in town, they have property, they're from a different country even. And they can and they come in and they put subdivisions in right next to us. I'm David Bugney's neighbor, by the way. And my house is right here. It's right here. It's right on the road. Right now the people are really wonderful. We walk the horses and the people right along this road on my property. And the people slow down. They're really good. You know, they don't make noise. All those people go in, I'm not going to have that anymore. It's going to hurt my clientele. It's going to hurt my people. And they're disabled people. They don't need to be ridiculed and teased. This petition is from people from Multnomah County and Clackamas County. These people did not know what they were voting for. They did not they thought it was somebody who lived on the property. They could subdivide it for their kids when they got older. You know, to hand it down in the family. They had no idea that they were going to be able to do what they're doing. And it's really got to stop.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one last panel that we're doing tonight. That's one I've called out. Was Dan Goffin, Fred Netter, and Carl, I believe it's Detweiler. Detweiler? For all those others that are here on the list, what we will be doing, we'll keep these lists. You will be first up if you can make it back here on Tuesday. And we'll be starting at 5 p.m. Dan?
Dan Goffin, DNR Farms, east of Salem here. I'm also a Farm Bureau board member. I'm also on Marion County Planning Commission. I've had to deal with this water-sensitive issue in the 217 acres. My motion Tuesday night was the one that passed, took some lobbying to get it through to restrict that development to the 5 acres, which was our intent when we did the groundwater overlay zone. But they wanted to use I call it fuzzy math. You've been reading the paper. I keep getting quoted. That's fine. But we need to figure out how to deal with sensitive groundwater. We have lots of them in Oregon here. Agriculture, Marion County is the number one ag-producing county in the state. We used to be 2-1 from Umatilla, but now Clackamas is sneaking up on us. But we're still the number one. We produce over 200 commodities, different crops, from berries, you name it. I raise cattle and grass seed. We cannot leave our machinery anywhere Dorfer Farms, Ioka Farms, they all have to road their machinery home every night down the highway, these big combines and everything. We do not dare leave anything sit out because of the public that is encroaching on us. We are forced to road our stuff home. That's dangerous. We have to have flag cars in front and rear. They still pass us. They don't care. They're impatient. Cascade Highway yesterday, doing 55. A motorcycle passed three of us on a solid double yellow line uphill at better than 90 mile an hour. If that car had been coming over the hill, he'd have been a statistic in the paper the next day. I'm here representing nine other farmers in the area. Kevin Dorfer, Doug Durs, Richard Sherman, Jim Johnson, Mike Thompson, Fred Netter, Walter Kloppenstein, Carl's here, and Don Schellenberg is also Farm Bureau. We need to have some kind of a regulation hold on the large stuff. The little ones that want to do, they've got their parcel of land. They've had it for many years legally established. Let them put the house on. That isn't the big issue. The big subdivisions that are going in are very detrimental to agriculture. The bridge is washed out. The train is running. There is nobody in the cab. All the passengers are screaming, we're going to die. We're going to have a wreck. And that is exactly right. Until somebody can step up and take hold of that throttle and pull it back and shut that train down, we're on a collision course. And it's up to this committee. It's been your challenge, your job, to figure out how to alleviate the problems, how to make it fair.
I already know how I feel.
Thank you.
Mr. Goffin, thank you. Mr. Netter?
Yes, my name is Fred Netter. I live in Aurora, Oregon, on a farm. And I really am not represented by the gentleman to my left. Fine. But I do have some things to say. The Honorable Senator George made a comment about his well out in the rural area, how he's got 70 gallons a minute. Water seems to be one of the major issues in this Measure 37 thing. I do irrigated agriculture. I submit that I use many more gallons per minute per acre in my agricultural pursuits than ever would be used with one or two acre parcels if it were put into housing. And I think that's true in most cases. It is up to the state to determine those areas that are water quality or water limited areas and regulate it according to that. But to carte blanche say that Measure 37 is not good because of the water things. If you're talking about taking irrigated agriculture out and putting it into houses, I submit there would be a net increase in groundwater in those areas. And that has been pointed out by one individual from Newburgh that testified here. I'd also like to say that Senate Bill 100, when it was passed, had a companion. That bill was for fair compensation for the people that were harmed by the passage of Measure 100 or Senate Bill 100. It does not need to be, this Measure 37 does not need to be suspended. It needs to be dealt with. And compensation was an issue. It is an issue. Location is an important thing. If you think about it, there's a big need for 1 and 2 acre lots. You can't find a 1 or 2 acre parcel to build on. But if it's next to a town, it's pretty much irrevocably committed. That's an LCDC term, to urbanization. If it is, why shouldn't that be approved regardless of what the acreage is? Eventually, it's going to be in there anyway. One other thing I'd like to make, final point, is the record in this state, as far as laws is concerned, is full of amendments to those laws. I mean, there's hardly a law that you can name that doesn't have an amendment, I'm sure. Measure 37 is a work in progress. Those laws that are passed and on the record, we're not suspended to put those amendments on there. Don't suspend Measure 37. Deal with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Carl.
Hi, Carl Detweiler. I farm in Silverton, Oregon. I'm here just to let you know that there's many challenges farming today that as a third-generation farmer that we face, and one of them is traffic. We've faced problems with traffic. The roads used to be market roads. That's what they were designated for. Anymore, people are using them for speedways back and forth. We have to use the main roads with our equipment anymore because of the width. We don't want to end up on a corner with a car speeding 55, 60 miles an hour. And the other thing is the groundwater. We don't know what we're going to do. We're running into problems with groundwater sometimes, and if we put houses out there, we got septic problems we got to look at. There's so many issues that we have to look at, and with being a farmer, the value of the ground has been outpacing what we can earn. That there's no way that as a farmer we're leasing a lot of our property because we cannot afford to buy it. And just recently, we had a Measure 37 claim filed on a piece that we leased, and the only way we found out was we had adjoining property that we did own. And so we really don't know what's going to happen with that. And my uncle, he's invested everything he's ever earned basically back into the farm except for a simple life that he lives on the farm. It's his livelihood. And when I voted for Measure 37, and I wouldn't do it again because I was under the interpretation that it would give maybe my son the right to build a house on our farm ground if he was farming or to continue. And that's I haven't heard anybody up here this evening talking about putting bunches of houses in or wanting to put bunches of houses. I've heard everybody say they'd like to put one or two houses, which is kind of the way I interpreted Measure 37. And so I look back and I really ask myself why there's so many subdivisions being proposed and that maybe we need to slow down and look at that and address that issue so we can, as a farmer, continue to look at farming in the future.
Great. Thank you very much. Again, I apologize to those that are on the list that we weren't able to get to. We did go about half an hour over just to try to get as many as we could. For those that were on the list, again, you will be first up on Tuesday if you come back. We will call your names out. We hope that you can. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being patient and listening to each other.
Boy, did people want to leave written testimony?
And lastly, if you have written testimony and you want to leave any written testimony, you can do that as well or submit it in place of coming back. Thank you. We're adjourned for the evening.